Hello and welcome to Inside Property. I'm Richard Blanco. In this programme, did landlords get off scot-free in the budget? And was it win-win for first-time buyers? With no-fault eviction now abolished on new tenancies in Scotland, we'll be considering the impact and asking what kind of devolved powers the Mayor of London might be seeking in his draft housing strategy. Finally, we will round the programme off with our thoughts on the regulation of agents, where the lettings market might be heading, and also testing the veracity of that hackneyed cliche, sky-high rocketing rents. I'm delighted to welcome back to the studio Sarah Davidson from This Is Money and the Mail Online. And we can't keep him away, Chris Norris, Head of Policy at the National Landlords Association. So, Chris, a lucky escape for landlords in the budget then? And there's a sense perhaps that all elements of the homeowner versus landlord taxation policy are now in place, given the reduction in stamp duty for first-time buyers, maybe?
Oh, I'm not sure you can ever assume that they'll stop tinkering. There wasn't anything devastating this time around, but equally there wasn't any respite from the changes that were introduced previously. So, I mean, there's a few interesting pieces that have come out of the budget, but I'm not really sure we can call it scot-free.
But at least, I guess, landlords escaped the increase in additional stamp duty that some people were trailing before the budget.
Some people, including me. Yeah, I thought that was quite likely to come along. You're right, we didn't see that. I mean, there were some stings in the tail. There's some relatively nasty changes to indexation for corporate landlords. And there's a few other bits and pieces that we could have seen some more movement on. But you're right, there wasn't the real damage that we expected to come along that we've really got quite used to after the last few budgets.
I noticed that little sweetener that mileage allowance is going to be allowed for landlords to help them with their businesses, I think the Chancellor said.
Yeah, I mean, it's a strange one, that. I think it's mainly to clear up a lot of confusion that's already out there. Speaking to lots of landlords after the budget, a lot thought that concession was already there. A lot have already been claiming it, possibly erroneously. And now it looks like the HMRC have advised that, you know, there's practice out there that isn't doing any damage, but wasn't maybe technically right. And it's been corrected. But you're right, it's a recognition that there really is business mileage and that it's a waste of everybody's time to record every single little journey and usage of a vehicle just so that you can fill in your tax return accurately at the end of the year.
And it's nice to hear that term business in relation to landlords and taxation, which, you know, many of us would like to hear more and more. Sarah, your thoughts on the changes for first-time buyers? 0% rate up to 300,000, and first-time buyers are eligible up to 500,000. They can claim that discount. It's worth up to 5,000. Do you think it's going to make a big difference?
I think in the short term, I spoke to an awful lot of first-time buyers in the immediate aftermath of the budget, and they were all over the moon, especially where house prices were very high. They were saving a lot of money, and that money is going to come in handy. But I think long term probably won't make that much of a difference. It's, in my opinion, more about winning votes back from younger people. And I don't think that it's actually going to achieve that. If you think about the people who are voting Labour, they're not suddenly going to switch because they've saved a bit of money. Also, in the northeast and northwest of the country, places where house prices are not so high, they might be saving 150 quid as a result of these changes, so it's not life-changing.
And someone argued the other day that actually this is going to help Bank of Mum and Dad more than first-time buyers because it means that they just won't have to stump up so much.
Quite as much money for the deposit. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was nice to see them make some move on stamp duty. I mean, it's something that, to be honest, I was completely cynical about them making any changes to that tax, because in the run-up to every autumn statement and every budget for the past 10 years, we've had the industry clamouring for change on stamp duty and very little movement on it. I don't think that this is really going to address the fundamental problems in the housing market, which are much more to do with mobility. If you give a first-time buyer the holiday on stamp duty, the house that they're purchasing is from a family who need to move up the chain. They're still being lumped with that enormous bill and can't move for the same reason. So I think it's not going to boost transactions. in the way that some people have argued that it might.
Yes, and stamp duty is still a particular problem higher up the market, sort of above 925,000 plus, of course. Now, Chris, the government said they will consult on the barriers to landlords offering longer, more secure tenancies to those tenants who want them. So what are these barriers, do you think, that the government are wanting to consult on?
Well, I suppose that depends who you ask. You ask most people, the barrier would be the landlord. It would be you and me. There's the flexibility to provide whatever tenancy is agreed between those two parties. So looking at it from that point of view, I suppose the consultation should be looking at how can we change our embedded views on what a tenancy should look like. I mean, to be entirely frank, we are still pretty much in the dark about exactly what this will look like. There was an announcement at the Conservative Party conference that there would be an announcement, and that became this proposed consultation. We expect to see it in the new year. There have been lots of discussions and kind of pre-development work about providing financial incentives, some kind of tax sweetener for landlords. But I think the bigger issue is just about behaviour. We've got 30 years of using the assured shorthold tenancy in a certain way that's built up. There's been lots of different levers at play. You know, there's been talk about whether lenders have restricted people, whether insurers have restricted, whether landlords just haven't trusted, you know, the other party, and whether tenants wanted particular types of tenancy agreement. But when you have a market that, from the landlord's perspective, has worked quite well for so long, it's going to take a little bit more, I think, than a few hundred pounds off of your tax bill to make people change that entrenched view. So, you know, we're going to see lots of nudges. I think what they're really going to need to do is engage with a very large swathe of the landlord community and find out what the barriers really are for them.
I mean, the stats tell us that the average tenancy is already close to 4.5 years. We know that most tenancies, the vast majority, are ended by the tenant. The potential for kind of 3-year mandatory tenancies, which of course was a Labour Party policy in the 2015 election, in my experience is very unpopular amongst landlords, because the idea that, you know, once you hand over the keys to a stranger, you're stuck with them for 3 years. Hopefully it will work out well, but of course sometimes it doesn't. And Shelter and other housing charities argue that households with dependent children now make up 35% of the private rented sector. So, you know, they really need this kind of security. Do you think there's much appetite for this, Sarah?
I think it's wrong to talk about it in a blanket term. You know, there are different needs depending on the type of tenant, depending on where they live, depending on their income, depending on whether or not they have dependent children, and therefore don't want to move because they don't want to have to take their kids out of school and put them into another school. I don't think it's helpful to talk about the need for long-term tenancies across the entire market. I'm a tenant. I certainly don't want to be locked into my tenancy agreement for longer than I absolutely need to be, because I want that flexibility of being able to move when I choose. That said, if you look at very vulnerable tenants who can't afford to see their rent go up year in, year out, every time they renew on an annual basis, it's those people, I think, that this consultation is looking to protect from kind of annual and rent rises that they can't predict and can't afford. So I think there needs to be flexibility in how it's applied if they do decide to bring in longer term tenancies. I also think that if you look at it from the financing point of view, if you lock into a 5-year fixed rate mortgage, then you know what your mortgage payments are and your outgoings are going to be for the next 5 years. That allows you to offer a 5-year fixed term tenancy without any financial risk, and the lender would presumably be okay with that. But if you are taking a 2-year fix and you're having to offer a 3-year tenancy agreement, then there's the risk that something drastic is going to change in the market, like with the budget tax changes, and that the affordability then is skewed in that final year of the mortgage. So, of the tenancy agreement, sorry, after you've expired, you know, your mortgage term has expired and you're having to remortgage. So I think it's way more complicated than there are barriers, people want them or they don't.
So I think from the finance point of view, there's another aspect to it as well. And that's insofar as the risk that the lender wants to take on. They might well, and they are increasingly being be more relaxed about slightly longer tenancies. I mean, I know my lender moved from a 12-month to a 24 maximum length tenancy. What they're really nervous about in talking to risk teams in banks is becoming the receiver. So if that landlord defaults, and okay, there should be no reason for them to default if that tenancy is healthy and the tenants are paying, but should something else happen and they become the LPA receiver or they become the landlord by default, they're quite worried about their responsibilities to either sell that property to maximise the return. They've got certain duties to maximise the return to the defaulting debtor, but they've also then got the potential to be tied into a tenancy that could go on for a longer period of time. So I think there's a lot of uncertainty when it comes to the lender's view in that. I don't think it's the major hurdle by any stretch of the imagination, but I think that's one of the areas that's been an issue.
And I was looking at the stats, and actually 44% of tenants are under 34s. There's been a huge increase in young people in the private rented sector, and I would imagine that many of them are actually happy with the flexibility that the current system allows. And, you know, that stat seems to get left out of the argument.
I mean, I think we have, as landlords, have got to look at this with fresh eyes, really. And the last thing in the world I would say is that we all need to turn around and start offering a mandatory longer tenancy. I think that's the nub of the problem. There isn't, as Sarah said, one size fits all. But equally, we've got to look at our businesses and say, are we running them the best way that we possibly could? You know, this is a tenancy and an average agreement length that's been in place since 1989. You know, do we need to run things the same way we did in the late 80s? Is the tenant profile the same? Certainly not. Is the size of the market and the potential return on longer term investments the same? Certainly not again. So I think we as landlords need to be looking at where we need to use a short tenancy, and that's probably at least half of the market, to protect our own interests and to give tenants what they want, but also where we should be talking to that tenant about what they want. Do they want a 3-year tenancy? Are they in, you know, fixed, reasonable employment where there are no real increases in risk for the landlord? If so, we could do ourselves and our industry a favour by offering that range before somebody turns around and says, no, everybody's got to have a 3-year tenancy, as, for instance, they're doing in Scotland.
Yes, well, coming on to Scotland from the 1st of December, of course, effectively, lifelong tenancies, from the tenant's point of view, called private residential tenancies, have come into play. They can be ended on 18 grounds, and some of those grounds include things like the landlord wanting to refurbish or sell the property or potentially move back in. But the tenant can stay there as long as they want. And I'm a bit surprised that Scottish landlords are not more up in arms about the reforms, Chris. What are you picking up?
I'm surprised you don't think they're up in arms. They're not very happy. I think the Scottish private rented sector has, depending on what side of the argument you're on, endured or benefited from a lot of reforms. This is the latest in a long line. As someone who has to try and lobby against some of it, they've been infuriatingly well thought out and planned in many cases. You know, it's no surprise that the NLA is not a great fan of the private residential tenancy agreement. The PRT completely changes the game. And as you say, the tenancies are indefinite, as long as the tenant is keeping up their side of the bargain. And I think we have to put that caveat in there. It's only indefinite if you're paying the rent and you're not breaking terms of the agreement and you're not guilty of antisocial behaviour and all of those different grounds that exist there. But landlords really are up in arms about this, particularly in hot parts of the market, particularly in areas of the market that would benefit from shorter tenancy agreements. If you talk to a student landlord in Edinburgh whose business model is predicated on letting for 10 months of the year to students and 2 months of the year during the festival, that means they can keep their student rents lower than they would otherwise and make a return. All of a sudden, they've got to take it on trust that their tenant will move out. And we're pretty sure that most tenants will actually say, no, I'll take an indefinite tenancy and sublet it myself, thank you, whether you want us to or not, because we know the temporary tenants will be out before you can take any action.
Well, Sarah, England has copied, or is indeed copying, you could argue, letting agent and court service reforms that have gone ahead in Scotland. Do you think there's an appetite for this kind of long-term tenancy or kind of lifelong tenancy in England?
Like I said before, I think it depends on who you are and what your priorities are and your income levels. but I think that it has been picked up in by English politicians as being very popular, in quotes, without much evidence to suggest that it would actually be. I agree completely with Chris. Hailing from Scotland, as I do, I've written a lot about the changes from as long ago as 3 years when they were first floated. And at the time, I spoke to all of the buy-to-let lenders who were active in Scotland, all of whom said, you know, we might actually pull out if these things go through, particularly given the rent controls that Scotland has brought in, which are based on if the government decides that rents are getting out of control in these hot zones, then we will cap rental increases by inflation plus N, where N is to be decided by ministers, which is completely, I mean, you cannot mitigate for risk as a lender. So I think it would be very dangerous to, for England to adopt the changes that Scotland has made without a lot of thought about how they apply. In Scotland, I think those rent caps are maybe slightly less relevant because I think rents are much more affordable as a rule. But yeah, I mean, it looks like it's heading that way. And I think there's a danger. So lots of work to be done on your part, Chris.
Is this a model, Chris, potentially for a Corbyn government, should Jeremy Corbyn ever make it to number 10?
I mean, Jeremy Corbyn has and has had for a very long time his own views on what housing should look like and whether there should be a role for private renting in housing at all. I mean, he, as a backbencher, introduced a bill, a private member's bill of his own every year for about the last decade or so, which would be quite familiar to the SNP in Scotland, I think, in many respects. I think a Corbyn government, you know, if we can take what they've said to this point as read, would go further. The rent pressure zones that they're that they've legislated for in Scotland, which thankfully aren't, I don't think, in place anywhere yet, but it's only a matter of time, are limited and, to be quite frank, are designed to take care of Aberdeen, where, you know, oil money has led to great fluctuations in rent levels. I think if we saw a Corbyn government next year, the year after, whenever it might be, we'd be looking at much broader rent control. Whether that would be what we tend to rather geekily refer to as first generation or second generation or later remains to be seen. Most of the discussion in England has been around second generation reforms, which are allowing the market to set the initial rent, but then saying you will have one of these formulas. And I hate it when formulae are set down in legislation because it gets horribly complicated. But to say what that would mean in the future, which we've always argued is a slightly strange way to go about it, because lots of landlords simply set a rent on day one and leave it alone for a number of years after that. Whereas if you tell people that there's a maximum or there's a cap, people tend to gravitate towards that cap. So I think it's an odd policy for someone who wants to level the playing field to look at.
I think also politicians are unaware that, you know, of this issue that landlords rarely raise the rent year on year. They tend to just raise the rent when the tenant changes. And it's actually in letting agents' interest to raise the rent annually because it brings them more commission. And actually, it's in their interest to have more churn and for more tenants to move on. So, you know, I would draw a very clear distinction between landlords and letting agents when it comes to raising rents.
Yeah, and it's in, you know, we've got to be honest and say that it's in human nature that if your trusted agent or even the adverts in your local area suggest you could get more with your new tenant, you will increase that rent. You know, I think we need to look at how we're setting rents. Most of rent increases, so far as NLA members tell us, are based on increasing costs and that calculation of cost and, yes, a margin on top of that. But there is this role performed by intermediaries in the sector. Increasing that rent on new tenants is, in some cases, beyond what is absolutely necessary.
Well, I'm reviewing all of my rents for next year, actually, and considering increasing them slightly where perhaps I wouldn't do normally because of the Prudential Regulation Authority changes, which mean that the stress test across my portfolio no longer allows me to borrow money. So that's putting pressure on me to increase rents. And I really regret that, you know, because I wouldn't have done so normally.
I'm having to do something similar with Section 24. I mean, I let to a local authority, which means it's a below market value rent, which simply won't be sustainable after the second year of implementation of Section 24. It's as simple as that. I have no intention otherwise to increase rents, but I'll have to, otherwise I'll make a loss.
I think what's very frustrating about this is, of course, landlords will get the blame, and yet it's kind of unjoined up government policy that's forcing people to do these things and behave in this way.
I think that's absolutely right, and I think you've got to come back to what is the government's objective here. And I don't think it's to create a better housing market for people. It's to try and win votes by coming out with sound bites that sound good. So, you know, longer term tenancies sounds great. That sounds safer to me. Capping rents, oh, that sounds good because I won't have to pay more than I'm already paying. Whereas in practice, we all know that the market is much more complicated than that, and it doesn't work like that. And as you say, landlords will get the blame, and there is just no avoiding that. So I think this is a real disconnect between the kind of the reality in the rental market and how politicians choose to talk about it.
You're listening to Inside Property with me, Richard Blanco, Chris Norris from the National Landlords Association, and Sarah Davidson from This Is Money and The Mail Online. Let's move on to London and the Mayor of London's draft housing strategy. Now, he's talking about wanting to encourage licensing across London boroughs and bring in a light touch registration scheme. 20 out of 32 London boroughs already have licensing or are consulting on this. I'm really unclear about how those two things could work together, Chris. Do you have any idea about this?
I think if you're asking any government or any politician to make policies that only work together, you're probably onto a long odd, to be honest. In terms of what the mayor wants to do, there's a very clear distinction between what the mayor would like to do and what the mayor is able to do. The mayor would like to license all of London under one scheme, under his control, and be able to set those standards and those levels. He's not able to do that. He's highly unlikely to get the powers to do that. But he is ultimately a lobbyist on behalf of London. So he will keep making these cases, these recommendations, these proposals to central government. I think what he is able to do is use the position of mayor to try and coordinate between local authorities, and that's why he'd like to try and promote licensing in the way that it is and look at different ways that you might be able to find out who the landlords are to make the case stronger for licensing. I mean, our argument would be that if you've got a light touch register, and there's definitely some merit in registering landlords rather than licensing them, you wouldn't need the license. And if you talk to people on, you know, particularly Frank and Honest Days from Waltham Forest, from Newham, a big driver behind those schemes was to find out where the landlords are. You know, best case scenario to talk to them, worst case scenario to enforce against them and impose more standards. But they wanted to know where they were. The best option for them that was cost effective was licensing. You get registration, you shouldn't need the licensing, but if you get registration, it's easier to license and it's more cost-effective to license, which is why you'd want those two things together.
Yes, and I'm quite a fan, actually, of a light-touch registration scheme, first mentioned in the good old Rug Review, of course, in 2008, which has just gathered a lot of dust since, I think. Sarah, Sadiq Khan's also keen to get more devolved powers on housing. And, you know, he may well look at the Scottish Government and be quite envious. Do you think he's likely to get any more devolved powers?
I honestly don't know the answer to that question. I would reiterate what Chris has said. But going back to the registration and the value of that and licensing, I think, you know, if we get a bit abstract here rather than the kind of practicalities of implementing that, there is a value to collecting information on a broader scale about how landlords operate, who they are, how many properties they've got, how good they are at keeping their tenants in, how many evictions they have, whether or not they're a particular perpetrator of evicting tenants on an annual basis in order to raise rents. I think, you know, we live in a world where big data and analytics are increasingly popular and actually can really help to create some level of understanding across a market so that can help inform policy in a much more, you know, useful and practical way. So I think there is definitely value. In terms of Sadiq Khan being able to impose rent controls in certain areas, I think probably that would appeal to him politically. So I'm sure he'll be arguing for it.
Yes, and of course lots of people would put Sadiq Khan and Jeremy Corbyn in number 10 together and think that those are powers he might get.
Absolutely. I mean, I think if you look at the Scottish model, this comes back to ideology. It's a socialist country. It really is, regardless of how they view financial services. And I think that that's, you know, the Corbynite Labour is much more akin to that than the kind of the Blairite days. So, yeah, absolutely.
Now, Chris, talking of central government ceding powers to local authorities, or I suppose the GLA and the mayor aren't local authorities, are they? But devolving power down more locally, I guess. Newham has finally got permission to bring in its almost borough-wide selective licensing. Interesting that the Secretary of State has forced them to have a sort of two-month period where they'll have no selective licensing. So they haven't been able to bring it in on the 1st of January, but they're going to bring it in on the 1st of March. What are your thoughts on this? Are you surprised?
Not really, no. I don't think there was ever any doubt that they would get the approval. They'd been sensible enough to amend what was an all-borough scheme to take out a few areas that really wouldn't hurt them a great deal, and they were getting a lot of pressure to remove. I think, as you mentioned, the two-month gap there is simply playing politics and, you know, making sure they're aware of who's in charge.
Pretty steep fees, though, from Newham. I mean, to say that it was £150 for a licence, that was the sort of early bird, as they often call it, early bird discount in 2013. It's now £450 for a selective licence, or £800 for an additional licence. And, you know, the average across England is between sort of 500 and 700. There are 67 schemes across England. Is this a worrying trend?
I don't think the selective licensing scheme, I mean, as you say, there was a big early bird discount, and Newham were one of the first really to use that kind of marketing ploy, really, to get people in early. We hoped they might do something similar to get the compliance up. We hoped they might recognise membership and accreditation with bodies like the NLA a little more, as some other local authorities have around the country. They're still in that average zone, really, for prices. And when we look at selective licensing schemes, as you said, they vary between about 450 and 600 for a five-year scheme. There are some that are much, much higher, and additional licensing tends to be a little bit more expensive because of the variations that you might have in licenses and the supposedly greater inspection that you need in an HMO. But I don't think the trend is necessarily for fees to go up. The trend is for more and more schemes. And we're certainly seeing that all around the country.
Agents look like they're going to become fully regulated very soon. Client money protection, a ban on fees. They already have to be members of a redress scheme, of course, and they're going to have to be members of a professional body. What do you think of this sort of regulatory regime that's being foisted on them, Chris?
Well, I wish the government would do it in one go, quite frankly. I mean, we at the NLA have been calling for a lot more letting agent regulation for a number of years. And it's been all of these components. And there are some very good professional bodies out there that have been doing this for decades or more. You've got UCALA that we have a relationship with. You've got ALA, NALS, the RICS. They all offer client money protection policies of one sort or another. They all offer guidance and a code of practice, which should govern fees. There's been some pretty bad practice when it comes to fees, but everyone knows what they should be doing. And there could have been more work to encourage that, and all of them included redress. So we've been saying for some time, just mandate belonging to one of these schemes or similar and get it over and done with. At the moment, I think what 2018 is going to illustrate is a lot of disappointment from landlords and tenants who think that letting agents have been regulated, because we've had so many announcements this year, whereas actually most of this won't come into force until 2019, some of it possibly later. So I think there'll be a lot of people, particularly tenants, turning up at letting agent offices thinking, well, I can't be charged a fee now. Or landlords, when they have difficulty with their agent, thinking, well, at least my money is safe. And actually finding out there's been a lot of bluster, but very little actual regulation yet.
Yes, I wanted to ask you, Sarah, I mean, do you think this could be the turning point for agents? I was looking at the figures in Newham where they have this star rating system from 0 to 5. 0 to 2 means that they've actually had compliance failures or criminal convictions is 0. And 67% of agents have a rating of 0 to 3. So, you know, 2/3 are down at that sort of bottom or mediocre end.
Which is really shocking. And entirely indicative of why the government has turned its spotlight on them for increased regulation. I think that the argument with regulation, regardless of if it's landlords or letting agents or estate agents or banks, is that you have to supervise those rules. You have to supervise the companies and make sure that they're adhering to them, and then you have to find them if they're not. And I think the problem here is not that there aren't standards already in place, but it's that nobody checks that letting agents are actually playing by the rules. So there's far too much malpractice and abuse of those rules, which is why they have such a bad reputation. So I think rather than focusing on more kind of convoluted policy, the government would be much better to say, right, we're going to set up a task force to check that whichever body you belong to, you are actually maintaining a certain set of standards, and that star rating is quite a good way of assessing whether or not agents are behaving properly.
Yes, Newham kind of leading the way with this star rating scheme. What do you think of it, Chris?
Well, as usual, Newham are leading the way in marketing communication. There are quite a few of these schemes around the country. Newham will always declare themselves first, best and leading, as you'd expect them to, I suppose. I suppose I should declare an interest. I was a letting agent in the dim and distant past, and I did work in Newham, Waltham Forest in Newham. What they're doing is fine. It's kind of based on that model for food safety. You have a star rating on your door and you know what to expect. I think the disappointment that we'd have in what Newham did was they didn't tell people what they were looking for before they went out and started this process. And to examine someone against a new set of criteria without actually telling them they were bringing in a new set of criteria, it seemed a little odd. I mean, once you've established a scheme, spot testing is absolutely essential to make sure people are doing what they need to do. But it did seem a little bit strange the way they went about doing it. We do now, thankfully, have the banning orders system coming into place and the rogue agent and landlord database coming into place. So there will be those sanctions for those who don't comply. I see that as a much more effective way of dealing with that really bad practice than making them put a sticker saying they've got a 0 star on the window. If they've got a 0 star, there should be some kind of sanction to drive them out of business.
I think there's also, I mean, there's limited value to that, isn't there? So say I'm a tenant and I want to rent a house and I want to rent that house on that street. I have to use the letting agent that the landlord has appointed, regardless of whether or not they've got 0 stars. So it doesn't actually mean very much other than it gives us a broad view of how poor standards are across the borough. In terms of what you were saying about, you know, if you're going to examine me, then tell me what you're examining me on. I think there's value in not doing that, actually, because I think if you give people a set of rules, then that, you know, as you were saying earlier, people gravitate towards the targets and the caps. In the same ways, if you give people a set of rules, they will work within those rules to the letter, and they will find ways of getting, you know, through the loopholes, if you like. Whereas if you just say we expect a certain standard of ethical behaviour, then that's a much broader definition, and it should technically, theoretically, encourage better standards.
On that basis, I absolutely agree. I think what the point I was trying to make was the star rating that Newham have used, and certainly some other local authorities have used as well, has, say, your first 1, 2 or 3 stars based on the law. You know, you're abiding by the law. And of course, you don't need to tell people what the law is before you inspect them on that. Your ability to get, say, a 4 and a 5 star rating is quite often connected to other parts of your business. So I'm not sure if this is the case in Newham, but there's certainly a scheme in the West Midlands where you can't attain a 5-star rating unless you actively let 2 local housing for allowance tenants, for instance. Now, I would say you can have a very, very good business, but you may not have a social imperative. You might not work with landlords who let to LHA. And it seems a little unfair to make that very good compliant agent put a 4-star rating on their door because they don't accept a certain type of tenant.
But then that's about the council's perspective, isn't it? I mean, their objective is to get more private landlords to support social housing. So, you know, I mean, I agree with you. As long as the tenant understands why there's a 4-star rating, that's the critical thing. But I would imagine that they're trying to encourage more landlords to get, or letting agents to get involved in that social housing provision.
I'm sure they are. It's just different objectives.
Sure.
Yes, and I think Newham, you had to get a 5-star, you had to not charge fees to tenants as well in Newham when the scheme was originally set up. So again, they're kind of putting their agenda into the star rating scheme. A quick look at what's going on in the market. Some interesting research out from Kent Reliance in the last few days. There's been a rise in purchases of rental properties through limited companies. It was 45% a couple of years ago. It's now 7 in 10 landlords purchasing in that way, certainly in their mortgage book. They also detect that fewer small landlords are adding to their portfolio, whereas landlords with 10 or more properties are more likely to have bought one more property in the last 3 months. And Andy Golding, who's chief executive of One Savings Bank, said, "We are seeing a fundamental shift as buy-to-let moves from being a popular pastime for hundreds of thousands of amateurs to the preserve of committed long-term investors with experience and expertise." Does that ring true for you, Sarah?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that all of the surveys from all of the different buy-to-let lenders in the market that come out on average once a week are all reiterating exactly that message. It makes sense financially for new properties. I think the difficulty is that we're talking about purchases, and that while new purchases can go in through a limited company if in the past you were a private landlord, and that can make the commercials make sense on the new additions to your portfolio, the existing portfolio problems that you might face as a result of Section 24 are still going to be there, and there are huge costs involved in selling from yourself into a company owned by yourself, because you trigger capital gains and stamp duty with the surcharge, you know, not to mention the cost of setting up a limited company. So I think I believe it absolutely for new purchases. I think the picture in the market is a bit more complicated than that. I don't think we can argue that already we're seeing a more professional sector and, you know, the demise of the small-time landlord.
Is this becoming a trend, do you think, Chris, or do we just not have enough data yet?
I think there are certainly trends out there. It's interesting to see the acquisition data. You know, obviously the lenders tell us about new acquisitions. I think what it doesn't necessarily show us is what's happening at the other end when it comes to disposals, because as we completely agree with Kent's data about new purchases and larger landlords still making purchases, our surveying also shows that those same larger landlords are selling at a slightly faster rate than they're buying. Now, we think this is rebalancing portfolios. It's not necessarily people exiting the market. It's selling off some of those properties that you own as an individual, buying different property into a portfolio, selling off ones that aren't performing very well. But it's indicating to us, in that middle bit of the sector, those landlords who've got a more professional, you know, non-hobbyist attitude, are starting to decline, I suppose, in their ambition. We're seeing the growth is still positive, but we've gone from a quarter-on-quarter growth of about 3-4% as an average down to something very, very low in the region of 0.06% at the moment, and possibly, if the trend continues, turning negative.
Buy-to-let was seen as an alternative to putting your money into a pension, wasn't it, Sarah? And that was certainly encouraged by, you know, buy-to-let mortgages that started in the mid-90s. Do you think those days are over now?
I mean, when we write a story that starts with a kicker in the headline, property versus pension, I think our website practically crashes, because it is still, by far and away, one of those questions that is asked of us day in, day out. The fact is, buy-to-let has performed over the past 25 years better than nearly any other investment because house prices have gone up. So when you are investing in buy-to-let for capital uplift over the long term, it still makes huge sense from an investment perspective. If you're investing for income, it's a little bit trickier now because yields in London and the South East, where you're likely to see that capital growth over the longer term, are not paying for themselves and are certainly not covering the stricter mortgage affordability requirements. And so you're needing to supplement with income. And if you're a retired person and you're looking for income rather than looking to support an investment asset with income, it just doesn't make sense anymore. That said, I think in other areas of the country, somewhere in, I think it's Liverpool, you can still get yields in excess of 12%. So for someone who is retired and needs that monthly income, that's a really good source.
Well, the question of yields brings me on to the issue that rents are not rising as high as they have been over the last few years. Current figures show that they're rising 1.5% nationally and 0.9% in London. Inflation currently stands at 3.1%, that's the CPI, and wages are rising by 2.1%. And yet I heard the Chancellor Philip Hammond just before the budget talk about sky-high rocketing rents. Do you think that's a misinterpretation of the figures now, Chris?
I don't think the Chancellor was talking to you or I at that point. There's certainly a cohort of people, of voters, should we say, out there that want to hear the government dealing with skyrocketing rents. If you look at the data, the trends, the historical data sets, about 2% has been your average for private rents over the last decade or so. That's not to say there aren't very large spikes between tenancies in parts of the country. So if you take London out of the data sets, for instance, you lose half a percentage point off of the England or UK national average. If you look at most years at the moment, it's a bit of an anomaly because London hasn't been performing that well. But it sells. People listen when you're talking about skyrocketing rents because everyone's got some experience of affordability. Certainly when we look at this, we look at the relative difference between rents and incomes. If wages aren't going up and historically have not gone up at the same rate, you're going to be paying a larger proportion of your income to pay for your housing. And it's a fact.
Yes, it's the lack of wage growth that's caused the problem, hasn't it, Sarah? But, we rarely see headlines about slowing rent increases, do we?
I think, yeah, it's not as sexy as sky-high rocketing house prices, is it? But I think there's a couple of things I'd like to say here. So sky-high rocketing rents, it's a complete anomaly because sky-high rents is one thing and rocketing rents is a completely different thing, right? And let's not confuse those two things. I think rents are sky-high in certain areas of the country, and that's regardless of whether or not they've stayed there for the past 5 years, because wage growth, as you say, has not moved in the past 10. So you are spending more of your pay packet on your rent proportionately than you were a decade ago. Whether rents are rocketing is a separate issue, and I would agree that they are slowing, but I think that's to reflect the fact that there is that pressure on wage growth. And also, these things go in line with house price growth, and house price growth is slowing as well. So there's that kind of, it's market dynamics, and I'm not sure that government policy is really going to have that much of an effect on how those dynamics move in the future.
Looking forward to 2018, then, something that could affect the market, of course, is another interest rate rise. Any tips on whether we'll get any interest rate rises this coming year?
I mean, the markets are pricing it in. There was talk about the next one coming in February. I'm not absolutely sure that that will happen. I think there are too many factors that the Bank of England will need to consider, and it will want to wait. All expectations for the housing market are that it's going to be flat next year or down. I think buy-to-let lending is supposed to be down a bit next year, though remortgage is going to be quite robust, I would think, as we were saying earlier, with landlords rebalancing portfolios. I think all of that has an impact on whether or not we see a rate rise. Obviously, we saw inflation hit 3.1% yesterday, and the governor of the Bank of England have to write to the Treasury to explain why it's so high. It's largely to do with the oil price, and I think the bank is forecasting that that will fall out, so inflation should come back down. That should ease pressure on the need to put interest rates up. I think the whole of the Brexit negotiations are going to be fundamental in terms of whether or not the bank feels safe. And don't forget, we also had in the budget the lowest ever GDP forecast from the Office of Budget Responsibility. It's anyone's guess. I think we'll probably see one next year, but I'm not sure when.
And Chris, Theresa May seems to have a spring in her step after the first phase of the Brexit negotiations. How likely are we to see an election in 2018?
Oh, I think if it's difficult to predict whether there'll be a rate rise, it's even more difficult to predict whether there'll be an election. My personal view would be up until 2 weeks ago, I would have said we were more likely to see an election in the first quarter of next year than a rate rise. As you say, May appears to be recovering, should we say, somewhat, or benefiting from some of this bounce. So maybe we'll get through another year. But it is anybody's guess.
Okay, well, that's it for the programme. My thanks to my guests, Chris Norris and Sarah Davidson, and to you for listening. Please do go to insideproperty.org.uk for useful links and to get in touch. Inside Property is produced in collaboration with the National Landlords Association.